Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Thank you so much for coming to the Tattered Cover tonight, and welcome. We appreciate your support of small businesses. Our author tonight is a man named Sen Quiñones. He's written a book about the devastating effects that addiction has had on small towns across America. So please welcome Sen Quiñones.
How's everybody in Denver tonight? Good? Great. Great to be here. I visited this town several times on my trek through this story. And one of the reasons is that the guys that I write about, part of the story in my book, Dreamland, is about a town in Mexico where everybody who comes here to the United States sells heroin retail like pizza. And this is they have a retail business model that has spread across the country. One of the main places they've set up a outpost is right here in Denver. Then Colorado Springs and Boulder as well. And my understanding for a while, is it Fort Collins? I cannot remember. There's another town that they've used as their hub. I kind of got on to these guys by... I was working at the Los Angeles Times for a long time, and I had lived in Mexico for 10 years. During that time, I wrote a lot about small villages and immigration from small towns in Mexico, and so I thought I understood how the towns worked and how that was an important part of immigration and also drug trafficking to the United States. I was put on a team of reporters in about 2008 to write about the drug war in Mexico. My job was to write about the folks who were trafficking drugs, who came across, and how drugs were trafficked in the United States. As part of that, I was Googling one day when I came across a series of stories about people dying of black tar heroin overdoses in a town called Huntington, West Virginia. Now, Huntington, West Virginia, I did not associate with heroin, nor did I associate it with Mexicans. Black tar heroin is made only in Mexico in this hemisphere. And so it struck me as very strange, like how on earth could a bunch of people die from black tar heroin overdoses in a town like Huntington, West Virginia? I made some phone calls and eventually was put in touch with a guy, a DEA agent from Columbus. He said, the cops in Huntington said all our drugs come from Columbus. So I said, okay, great. Called him, talked to him. And he told me this amazing story, this weird, weird story. He said, about 10 years ago, our heroin world got turned upside down. In fact, we really didn't have any heroin 10 years ago. But a bunch of Mexican guys began to come to Columbus, and they began a system that was of retail sales. They drove around delivering heroin by the tenth of a gram balloon. And balloons doses about a tenth of a gram, they hold them in their mouths. They have 20, 30 of these in their mouths. They carry a big jug of water. So if the cops pull them over, they swig it all down, and it looks to the cop just like a normal kind of guy just driving around. He said they have this system built into Columbus now. They have numerous crews doing this. They act like fast food franchises. They are impossible to eradicate. We arrest them all the time, and these guys send new guys up. And then he told me something very, very weird. He said, you know, the strange thing is that they're all from the same town. And that really struck me. I had been in Mexico 10 years, and I had written about a lot about small-town Mexico. What I knew about small-town Mexico was that in many places all over the country, really, you find this, that one town has, people in one town will have the same occupation. I've written stories about towns where everyone's a construction worker. In my first book, True Tales from Another Mexico, that I wrote a good 12 years ago now, I wrote a story about a town where all the people were popsicle makers, and they had popsicle shops all across Mexico, but they all were from this one town. This was normal to me. The reason this happens is because in Mexico, poor working class folks don't have access to education that would allow, say, a popsicle maker's son to become a mechanical engineer, for example. So you do whatever is closest to you. You do. If your uncle does this, a job, you do it. I wanted to write my last couple of months in Mexico before I moved to the States. I was trying to finish up a story, I never quite did it, about a town where every man in the town is a pimp. They traffic women to Queens, New York. It's a town not far outside of Mexico City. You find, I know towns where everyone's a tortilla maker. Everyone's a cop. They become cops all across the country. This is a normal thing. So when he told me that all these guys are from one town, it kind of rang true. I knew that this was possible. I had seen it. I had seen it before. And so I set about finding out about this town. Turns out the town is named Jalisco. If you know anything about Mexico, there's an enormous state called Jalisco. It's where Guadalajara is located. This is a very small town in a very small state called Nayarit. It's on the Pacific coast. And for a long time, I began to just kind of send out letters. I believe I've been a crime reporter for a long time, and I believe heartily in finding the stories in prisons. Jails, if you reach out to folks in jail, in prison, they will talk to you. And this is what I did. I began sending out notes to people and letters saying, hey, do you want to talk to me? Took names off of big indictments out of Columbus. And I thought it was a really great story that I could write about a town that trafficked heroin to Columbus. One town, small town that I'd never heard of. 10 years in Mexico, never heard of this place. Jalisco, Nayarit. I sent out about 15 letters, 20 letters maybe, I can't remember. One guy called me back. A guy was in prison in federal prison. Doing 15 years for having been an operator. The system he described was very much like what the guy told me. He said the addicts will call a number. There's got operators standing by. Again, this is kind of like pizza delivery, right? Operators standing by, taking the order, and then dispatching the driver to a series of drivers all around the town, dispatching one driver, whoever is closest, to the attic, to say a Burger King parking lot or a shopping center of some kind, and there the addict and the driver meet. The driver spits out the you know, five hits or whatever. Boom, addict gives him his cash and the guy's on his way. And this kind of system works 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. They use business hours, very much like a business. And he was telling me all this about how this, and he says, yes, it's all from this one town, but they don't just go to Columbus. This system that they have used has allowed them to traffic drugs all across America. He began to name off states, Charlotte, Denver, Portland, Reno, Salt Lake, Indianapolis, Cincinnati, Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Phoenix, a bunch of others, Cincinnati. So this just totally took me by surprise, that one small town, about 20,000 in a county of about 45,000, could be an enormous supplier, probably one of the principal suppliers of heroin to the United States all across the country. And then I asked them, well, what about New York City? I mean, I grew up in the 70s. I grew up watching, you know, Serpico and French Connection 1 and 2 and all those great heroin movies from New York City in the 1970s. He says, no, they never go there. They only go where there's no competition. These guys are utterly nonviolent. They don't shoot it out for territory. They compete with each other, but they don't use guns. They compete on price and on customer service. They will call the client later, hey, was the dope any good? Was the guy on time? They will give price discounts. Buy a hit every day, 6 days a week, you get a free one on Sunday. That kind of thing. the further I got into this story, the weirder it got. You know, there's more strange. And the idea that one small town could be supplying so much of our heroin just blew me away. I began to try to find out as much as I could about this town. Excuse me. I went down to it for 5 days. I went down with a colleague from the LA Times, a photographer. It's the only time in my life, I've been a reporter almost 30 years, the only time in my life where I've ever lied about what I did for a living. Normally, people ask me, I tell them I'm a reporter. This time, though, was the first time when I said, well, we're Spanish instructors, and we're trying to improve our Spanish to teach our kids better back up in the California, you know. I did that because I was terrified, basically. The headlines out of Mexico were about decapitations and all the rest that I'm sure you all have heard. And so I just wanted to keep things as quiet as possible. But along the way, I began to learn about this town and why this system would spread to so many places in the United States. One thing I had noticed as I traveled and written a lot about, as I traveled across Mexico, is every immigrant village you go to, everyone, part of the skyline is rebar. Rebar sticking up out of the houses. You see it everywhere. Now, why is that? Very, very easy to understand why that is. A lot of folks come here. They work as landscapers. They're working legitimate occupations, meat packing houses, construction, restaurants, whatever it is. They save their money and they send it back and they build, but they don't have enough. They don't make enough in these jobs to build a house all at once. So they build it piecemeal, a room here, a room there. For pretty soon, after 6 or 8 years, they've got the first floor done, but they don't have enough money to finish the second floor. So they put rebar up all around the house to, as a kind of a promise, to allow people to tell people, I'm building this second story as soon as I get enough money together. I can tell you, 10 years in Mexico, I visited dozens and dozens of villages, immigrant villages all across the major states of Mexico, Oaxaca, Michoacán, Sinaloa, Zacatecas, Jalisco, and every place I went, there was rebar. The lone town, the only town I've ever been to that did not have rebar is Jalisco, Nayarit. That was the first thing I noticed. I drove around town, walked around town, and there was no rebar coming out of the houses. What that meant is that heroin had upped the ante. Now, in order to be kind of like rise socially, you had to deal heroin, because otherwise you had a house that took 6 or 8 or 10 years to build. You were kind of the laughing stock of your neighborhood. Heroin allowed you to build that house in 9 months, maybe a year. It allowed you to put in things like automatic garage door openers, which had never been seen in a couple of the villages surrounding Jalisco. They never had these things. The first guy, I talked to one fellow, he said, the first guy in my village who ever put up a garage door opener, all the old folks in town stood out front, in front of the house, just watching the door go up and down and up and down. This is the kind of the social elevation that heroin allowed in this area. There's a great T-shirt that I'm kicking myself. I saw in a liquor store years ago, and I never bought for some reason. I wish I had. on it said in Spanish, "La vida recia porque cuando eres pobre te humillan." That means in Spanish, that's the fast life, the drug life, because when you're poor, they humiliate you. And it's the rise up out of that humiliation that means so much to immigrants of all kinds, not just these guys. A big part of why people come from Mexico to the United States is because they want to end that humiliation. Part of being poor in Mexico is this constant humiliation. Your mother being talked down to by the local butcher because she's coming in and going to ask for credit, and he knows it and he doesn't want to give it. Complete and constant humiliation all the time. Immigration happens largely because people want to end that humiliation, and this is just, the heroin trade is just that times 10. The houses they were allowed to build, that heroin allowed them to build, ended that kind of uneven thing, social balance in a sense. And so people now who began to sell heroin through this system would walk into a store with their mother, and now the butcher would, "Oh, senora, how are you? Welcome." You know, he knew she wasn't going to be asking for credit anymore. It totally leveled the playing field socially in that town. One of the reasons, because of that, it began to spread. They started in Canoga Park and Van Nuys in San Fernando Valley. And from there, they spread out. The first places they went to were Denver, Portland, Honolulu, led by addicts. Addicts would take them, say, "Hey, you should go to Denver. You should go to Portland. I know some places." And they would follow and set up their system. And those pizza delivery systems have been in those towns ever since, like the late 80s, early 90s. They began to spread, though, and because they had huge amounts of labor available back home, guys would raise their hands. They would see, "Geez, my uncle built his house in 6 months or 9 months. I want to go too. I want to build my own house. I don't want to be the laughing stock and take 10 years to build my house." The other thing that pushed this system across the United States was that people back home realized that this system was a perfect system to turn very cheap heroin. They bought the opium goo from Indians in the mountains nearby. They would cook it into black tar heroin, send it here. They realized as time went on that it was dirt cheap for them to make. They realized as time went on that this system was a fabulous system for turning very cheap heroin into enormous stacks of Levi's 501 jeans. This was enormously important in why this thing spread. Back then, in the 90s, particularly as this system was spreading across the country, Levi's 501s were like kind of the gold standard of rural men's wear in Mexico. They are very well-made jeans. They're very expensive. They're really dark blue, and they're in stark contrast to most of the jeans that were available, Mexican jeans that were available, which are flimsy and cheap and looked poor. The dealers in this system, in Canoga Park first and San Fernando Valley, but then later here and other places, realized as time went on that they could transform these little, tiny, cheap hits of heroin into Levi's 501s because the addicts they were dealing with were fantastic shoplifters. They figured out, hey, these guys, these dealers will want Levi's 501s. Pretty soon, they were showing up with three or four. They could clean, a few addict shoplifters can clean out a JCPenney's or a Sears or a Target in no time. So as time went on, they developed this kind of relationship where they realized they could barter for dope, the addicts did. And what these guys wanted most was Levi's 501s. They would go home, talk to people who did this. They would go home with trunks, trunkfuls of Levi's 501s and hand them out like Santa Claus. It was like the Santa Claus had come to town. People would talk about their visit for, you know, days ahead of time. "Oh, so Juanito's coming home. Oh, we're going to kill a cow. Oh, he's going to have lots of gifts." The gifts were, most of the time, Levi's 501s. As people saw that this system was a fantastic way of turning heroin into quickly made houses, but also fancy Levi's 501s, and saw guys they'd gone to school with walking around town on Friday night in their beautiful Levi's 501s, people signed up. People raise their hand, "I want to do this." And that is one of the main reasons why this thing spread. It allowed poor people kind of an access to a life and also a better social standing in this town. So it never lacked for, this system never lacked for labor. That was a crucial point of it. Talk to all the cops, including here at cops in Denver. They will arrest and arrest and arrest and arrest these guys, and there will always be new guys taking their place. What's more, it pushed the system. Because they didn't fight, you know, like the Colombians did back when they were introducing cocaine in the 1980s. There was no massacres or shootouts between these guys. They competed on price and on customer service. But once there was enough of them in a town, too many of them in a town, profits dropped. They had to find new places to go. They were able to find new places to go because there was always new guys willing to work. And so they spread. They moved across the country. Starting as I say, in the West, and eventually moving east across the Mississippi River. The first time black tar heroin's ever been seen east of the Mississippi River is when these guys bring it in 1998, and they land in Columbus, Ohio. The very place I started finding out about them. But I realized as I got into this story that really I was dealing with the second half of the story. Why, of course, the big question was, why would there be a lot of heroin demand in West Virginia, you know? And with that, as I got into this, I realized there was another part of the story that had nothing to do with these guys, but that these guys had discovered. And that had to do with a revolution in pain management in the United States. This revolution began in the mid-80s, got really revving up in the 90s, and is with us today. It held that we are a country in pain, and that we need to treat pain of all kinds. And what's more, it held that the way to treat that pain was with pills, with opiate painkillers. Vicodin, you may have heard of these pills, may have been prescribed these pills. Vicodin, Percocet, of course, OxyContin, which comes out in 1996. This revolution, promoted at first by certain pain specialists, I believe there were basically decent, well-meaning people who had lived through a period of time when we doctors never prescribed these drugs for any reason, even to terminal cancer patients who were in utter agony. They never prescribed these pills. They had grown up as young doctors in this, saw how inhumane it was, and said, no, we got to change that. They kind of developed a revolutionary or religious fervor for this stuff and began pushing the idea, first, that we should change the way terminal cancer patients receive these drugs, but then also that pendulum kept on sweeping into now we need to treat all surgery with this. You get your wisdom teeth extracted, you get a Vicodin. You get I had my appendix out. I got two Vicodin in the hospital and a big bottle of 60 Vicodin to take home with me in case I needed it. This was crucial. This was that bottle of Vicodin that I received was like a symbol of this revolution, because that revolution held, it was crucial to this revolution and believed by doctors across the country that these pills were, quote, virtually non-addictive when used for pain treatment. That was the buzzword, virtually non-addictive. These pills, you need to understand, are opioids. They call them opioids. They're basically molecularly very similar to the morphine molecule, what's in morphine. So the drugs in these pills, oxycodone and hydrocodone, are very similar molecularly to heroin, which is why we have the problems that we have today. This revolution takes hold in the mid-90s, really in a big way in the 1990s for a whole lot of reasons I go into in the book, and begins sloshing around. The pills begin, we get this really like kind of a rising sea level of pills all across America. One place that I talk about in the book that really got hammered, the kind of the ground zero of all this area, of all this revolution, is this area with Columbus to the north, Cincinnati to the west, Wheeling, West Virginia, and eastern and western Pennsylvania to the east, and eastern Kentucky and some other areas right there. One town that I talk about in the book is a town called Portsmouth, Ohio. Portsmouth, Ohio, is on the beautiful Ohio River right across from Kentucky. It's in Appalachia, but once was a great industrial town. It had steel mill. It had numerous shoe factories. It had a whole lot of businesses, local businesses, a bustling Main Street. It also had, it was like all-American town. You know, it had the first NFL night game. The team in Portsmouth, that tells you how kind of bustling this town was at the time. The town had an NFL team. That team later moved a couple of times and became the Detroit Lions. It also had this gorgeous, beautiful, enormous swimming pool the size of a football field, probably the largest swimming pool in America, one of the two or three largest swimming pools in America. Life itself took place in this swimming pool. It revolved around this enormous swimming pool. If you were three, you were in the toddler section, the shallow end. By seventh grade, you were in the middle section. You know, by high school, you were jumping off the diving board in the deep end. The guy who owned it for many years also owned a shoe factory. Didn't need the money from the pool, and so reinvested. So it was like this place. There was always room for more. He was always expanding it. More fields, more, a baseball field, basketball courts, picnic area, and they called this pool Dreamland. It was kind of a metaphor. It took it as this great symbol of America for so many years. The community was held together by Dreamland. Kids were watched. Kids grew up under the watchful eyes of 100 different parents. Dreamland was the cheap babysitter. You could drop your kids off and know that every parent there was going to watch your kids, make sure your kids didn't get into anything. Of course, weren't always successful. A lot of people lost their virginity at Dreamland, too. It was an enormous place. I went on Facebook one time, and in a Portsmouth, Ohio diaspora Facebook page, and I said, tell me all your great memories of Dreamland. And it just went on for days. People are all over the country began, oh, this copper tone, oh, the French fries, oh, I kissed my first girl. On Friday nights, we'd have dances, and we'd all kind of, you know, if we had a new girlfriend, we'd walk around, and we would announce our little romance by walking around the pool at Dreamland, you know. Excuse me. Industrial decline came in 1980. The steel mill left Portsmouth. The shoe factories that were leaving as well. Main Street began to hollow out. The farm crisis, which is a rural area too nearby, so the farm crisis probably had something to do with this as well. And in 1993, Dreamland closes. It's like a death blow, a stab in the heart to this town. It's hard to imagine just what it meant to so many people who live there, but with it, the town kind of lost its central core. It was dug up, and it's now like some Joni Mitchell song. It's a big parking lot, literally, a big parking lot where this glorious pool used to be. It's now a strip mall where I believe there's an O'Reilly's Auto Parts and an AT&T store right there where Dreamland was. with the kind of fragmentation of the town, the debilitation of the town, a lot of people left. Walmart took Dreamland's spot as the place where everybody saw each other. Main Street was dead, you know, there was nothing there anymore. So people saw each other at Walmart. That was the only place. Cops became the parents. Those hundreds of parents who would watch your kids, now it was only the cops who were doing. People kind of withdrew inwardly. You know, they'd stop going outside. There wasn't as much playing in the street. And in this fragmentation, this isolation, opiate painkillers come out and make quick work of this town. This town becomes, in fact, the place where the pill mill is literally invented. The pill mill is what grows up out of the pain revolution. These are doctors' clinics. They look like doctors' clinics, except for the doctor has either lost his scruples or had none to begin with, and is selling prescriptions basically for cash, $250 cash, and a 90-second... you know, how you doing? You look, oh, you're paying? Okay, here. And a very long prescription of pills, Xanax bars, et cetera, on down the list. Millions of pills are prescribed by these pill mills in Portsmouth, Ohio. It just destroys the town. A whole generation, judges' kids, cops' kids, everybody's kids gets addicted to these pills. Almost an entire generation of kids in Portsmouth, Ohio get addicted. And so prevalent are the pills that in Portsmouth, Ohio, there develops this weird phenomenon. There is an actual OxyContin, a pill economy. The pills are what matter. Everybody's addicted to opiates. Cash, no one wants cash. So with pills, and pills make perfect currency, because they're all, you know, you can get five 5 milligram Vicodin, 10 milligram Vicodin, 30, 8, 40, 80 milligram OxyContin. They're denominated like bills. The pill mills are the central banks maintaining the currency, so there's no big shocks to the currency. So there's no devaluation or inflation. And after a while, you can buy anything in Portsmouth for pills. You can buy T-bone steaks, cable service, dental checkups, everybody you can pay in pills because everybody's addicted. The dealers who are dealing the pills make up lists. They have legions of addicts. And again, these addicts are amazing shoplifters who will go steal them anything. I need a Black & Decker buzzsaw. Boom. Tomorrow, a guy brings them a Black & Decker buzzsaw. He's lifted. Key to all this, key to this entire OxyContin economy, was Walmart. Walmart was, as I said, took the place of Dreamland as the social center, but it also replaced Main Street and almost every other shop in town. It was the one place that you could go as a junkie shoplifter and steal everything that a dealer asked you to steal. If it was August and school was coming up, the dealers needed shoes for their kids and school supplies for their kids, boom, Walmart had it. It had T-bone steaks. It had Black & Decker buzz saws, circular saws. So in time, that was the only place it had. Main Street was done. There was nothing there. I always thought, as I was got into this story, that had there been more of a diverse economic ecosystem in the places where it started, which is these areas around Portsmouth for a couple hundred miles around, had there been more of a diverse economic ecosystem, meaning had there been larger options for commerce, had Main Street survived, it would have been a whole lot more difficult for this pill thing to have expanded, because every merchant on Main Street would have defended their store. It was their livelihood. Plus, they knew the addicts personally. They would know these guys. But in Walmart, Walmart pays $10 an hour, or not even sometimes, no health insurance. No one's going to battle a wide-eyed junkie who's coming to steal his daily fix. And so basically, Walmart became the place where you could just steal what you needed for your addiction almost every day. And if you got recognized and thrown out of Walmart, there was a Walmart 20 miles away in almost any direction you wanted to go. These areas, Portsmouth and other areas, were the ground, as I said, ground zero. They were kind of the canaries in the coal mine of addiction in America. Had we paid attention as a country to what was going on in these areas in 1998 and 99 and 2000 and 2001 and a few years after that, and had we made significant changes in the way these pills were prescribed and a variety of other things, we may well have avoided what we now are dealing with, which is widespread addiction. Because after a while, the story that took place there began to spread across the country. It started in low-income areas, places that were voiceless, places that were forgotten, places where they'd been abandoned by the very people who lived there, places like Portsmouth, Ohio, places that were easy to ignore. But then it spread, and it spread to areas where people were much better off. It spread to the areas, it was strange to watch, it spread to the areas that had done best in the economic run-ups beginning, say, the mid-1990s. Charlotte, Indianapolis, suburbs of these areas, Denver, Portland, places like that really were part of, they had benefited the most. It struck me as very strange, I thought, that as time went on, we saw people from the classes that had benefited most, their kids getting addicted to drugs used, of all things, to numb pain. You would go by these communities, go through these communities. I did this in Charlotte one time, and talked to a cop there, and he said, we were driving around, and he said, you know, like, what pain? Where's the pain? I don't, you know, it looks like things are perfect. Well, we know that they weren't, but this is where it spread. And it was spread there because we didn't pay attention as a country to where it started. The first alarm bells were going off in Appalachia for years before this. So as I got into this story, as I began to write this story, it of course started as an immensely depressing story. The wealthiest country in the world, a country that before years ago, like in the 70s, we almost used no opiate painkillers. Now we use 98% of the world's supply of hydrocodone. That is a pain revolution right there. 83% of supply of the world's oxycodone. So as I got into it, I was very attuned to kind of find, let's find the hope here somewhere. And so it was. I was struck. It was really touching, in fact, and surprised to find that the place where I could go to find hope was in the place where it all started, which was Portsmouth, Ohio. Let me start first by saying my feeling is that this opiate epidemic is basically un-American. Now, that sounds strange because look how much dope we use, and there's a CVS pharmacy everywhere, and there's medical marijuana all over the place now. And you would think that drug use, we would be known as a country of drug users. That's true, we are. But the great idea in this country, I believe, is self-reliance, self-determination, you determining your own future. And the place I saw this was in Mexico, when I lived in Mexico. I saw millions of people streaming north with one idea. The idea was to shape their own future, to be in charge of their lives in some way, in a way that was not possible in small towns. And in fact, it's what motivates, I believe, these Jalisco boys, the guys from Jalisco Nayarit. They're motivated by that idea. I am a butcher. I'm a baker. I'm a sugarcane farm boy. Other people, other forces determine my life, and I don't want it. That is the great idea, I think, in our country. And I noticed it, as I said, and I felt it deeply when I was in Mexico. Opiate addiction is the opposite of that. It's control by this unseen molecule. It's enslavement to the idea of pursuit of painlessness, wanting to be numb. And therefore, I believe it's essentially an un-American kind of thing. I saw this most clearly, though, in Portsmouth. I went there once, and I thought, Lord, that is one beat-up town. My God. I mean, I never wanted to go back. But I kept on going back. I'm not really sure why I went back a second time, honestly. But as I kept going back, I began to realize that there was another story deep inside Portsmouth that was, on the surface, it looked battered. It had been battered by every economic force, every political force you can name for the last 40 years. But deep down inside it was something really profound and strong and beautiful. I began to see it first when I came upon a strange story. They had, and they still have, in Portsmouth, an enormous shoelace factory. It's the last vestige of the shoe industry that existed for 100 years in that town. It was at one point in its life the largest shoelace manufacturer in America. It's an amazing thing. One of the cool things about being a reporter is you get to go to places where they make stuff that you know. I've been to typewriter factories. I've been to coupon counting factories in Juarez, where they count every one of y'all's coupons. Believe it or not, they do. But this was wild. These big machines and these bobbins going like this, pivoting and twirling and swirling, kind of like the Harlem Globetrotters, you know, deafening thing going on. It was just wild. This shoelace manufacturer actually worked really, really well. But what happened was, according to the people I talked to, the third generation took it over. Now, third generation in Rust Belt America has a real deep meaning that I did not realize. It refers to the the first generation, it's the guy who starts his business and goes out and doesn't really know much about business, but he's got a lot of work ethic, and he goes and he starts a business. The second generation goes to business school, learns how to run the business smarter. Third generation wants to play golf all day. And that's what happened to this shoelace manufacturer. It was doing very well. It knew how to make shoelaces very, very well, but the guys who owned it were running it into the ground with dumb decisions, bad mistakes, not enough work, and not enough attention to the place, and it went into bankruptcy. Portsmouth, Ohio had been watching its future be determined by other forces for 40 years and sat haplessly by and let it happen until the last factory was about to close. This shoelace factory. And it was then that the town, kind of flat on its back like a boxer or maybe like a junkie, hitting rock bottom, decides, no, okay, it's time. We can't do this anymore. A group of small businessmen from the town, an insurance salesman, a lawyer, a couple of contractors, some others, decide they're going to pool their money. They buy the company out of bankruptcy. They hire the managers who know what they're doing. They're not the owners. The managers who are on site all the time. And they resuscitate this shoelace manufacturer. This was in 2009, 2010, then 2011. It took a while. But finally, they resuscitated this company. By the time I came on this company, it had 90 employees, up from 24. And it was exporting shoelaces to China and Mexico and Taiwan. But it was more than that. It was this sense of the town finally saying, enough, we're going to determine our own way forward from here. The town then kind of built on that, I think. Kind of, it takes a little bit of positive kind of victory, in a sense, to get people thinking, hey, we can do this. They begin to reform municipal governance. I am a longtime reporter. I've covered city halls in a couple of occasions in my careers, and I have a deep, deep appreciation for small-town government when it's run by a city manager. It's a very effective form of government. In Portsmouth, they thought, screw it. Let's fire the city manager and have the mayor run the town. Well, this led to all kinds of nonsense. The mayor was depended on who was elected. One time it was a grocery clerk, then a pastor, and then this kind of thing. Finally, they decide, let's get professional about this again. You know, they hire a city manager, and they began doing little things like putting lights in a park, and all of a sudden, all the prostitutes go away. Wow, what a surprise. This kind of thing begins, but also what begins to happen as time goes on and this kind of spirit of taking charge again enters the town. They close the pill mills. The state passes a law regulating pain clinics, which for the first time says that you cannot be a felon and own a pain clinic. Before, you could be a felon and own a pain clinic. A lot of them did. They close, with that law, they close all these nasty pain clinics that have been pushing drugs in the face of every kid in that town for a decade. They hold marches in front of them. Grows up this real sense of, like, we can do this, which had been lacking in the town for many years. And with that comes a kind of a breathing space. The addicts kind of have some space. They're not always having these pills pushed in the face. And as time goes on, a whole population, a whole recovery culture emerges. Today in Portsmouth, the estimate is something like 10% of the town is in recovery for opiate addiction. That's an amazing number of people, 2,000 people. There is infrastructure now that there wasn't before. There's a lot of NA meetings all over town. Almost every day there's an NA meeting at least once a day, sometimes several a day. There's also, really important, there's mentors. There's people who have been 3-4 years clean now. So if you're just getting off it and you have some problems at 3 in the morning, you can call somebody. And in Portsmouth, Ohio, this was really a big deal. The town itself is showing us, I believe, the town that led us into this, like this junkie, kind of beaten down, addicted to all kinds of dependencies, is kind of emerging out of it, saying, throwing off those dependencies in this really beautiful way, and showing us maybe the way out of it. What's also happened is all those people who are in recovery, it's almost, when I covered Mexican immigration a lot, what I definitely noticed was Mexicans would bring a huge amount of energy to a town. They would come, and they were people who would walk through walls to get ahead. I covered Katrina, New Orleans after Katrina. I was there for about 6 weeks. All these Mexicans began arriving. They were there to do whatever it took to put the town back together because it meant work. It turns out that recovering addicts are quite a bit the same way. It's almost like Portsmouth got this huge infusion of Mexican laborers almost with these new addicts who were in recovery and grateful for the second chance and eager to do almost anything it took to move ahead, to leave behind what they were escaping. I end the book this way. So the battered old town had hung on. It was somehow a beacon embracing shivering and hollow-eyed junkies, letting them know that all was not lost, that at the bottom of the rubble was a place just like them, kicked and buried but surviving, a place that had, like them, shredded and lost so much that was precious, but that was nurturing it again. Though they were adrift, they too could begin to find their way back to that place called Dreamland. Thanks very much for coming out tonight. Appreciate it. Any of you have any comments, questions, ideas that you want to throw out? I'm sorry, get to you a minute. Yeah. Uh-huh. Did you write me? Were you one of the... I'm sorry. Were you the one of the folks who wrote me about that?
Yeah.
Yeah, fine. Keep going. Yeah.
Can you just go a bit...
Sure.
Does that apply throughout the country?
Yeah. Well, no, not it. Well, let me put it this way. The question is, in the book, I write about this Jalisco heroin system. And one of the ways people in this system recruit new customers is to hang out in front of methadone clinics and pass out free samples. This is really a strategy adopted from the guy who really brought the system east across the Mississippi River. I tell his story in the book. He was a strange aberration in the system because he was not from Jalisco. He was actually Mexican-American, grew up in Van Nuys, was a longtime addict, and got to know one of these Jalisco guys in prison in Nevada when they were there in the early 90s. They get to be friends, and when they both get out, they start these systems. Well, he had been a longtime methadone client. He had been a junkie since he was 19. He was about 50, in his 50s when he gets out of prison. So... the idea of going by, he knew methadone clinics. In fact, that's one of the things he brought to this system. The guy, the other kid that he was he befriended in prison from Jalisco said, you know, we have access to all the supply. It's top notch. We have also this system that my uncles and cousins and brothers are using in different parts, and I'm going to use when I get out of prison. We also have a whole labor pool out there, huge numbers of people, kids, who will raise their hand to come north and work. What we don't have is a connection to the junkie world. We don't understand. We don't speak English. We're not junkies ourselves. We don't understand. We need somebody who knows that world. That's an entirely separate world, as you know. If you know addicts, you know that there's this kind of separate universe they all live in, and they all know each other and speak the same language. And so this guy, that's what he brought, a knowledge of the junkie world, a knowledge of methadone clinics, because he had been part of them. And yes, they began handing out free samples at methadone clinics. It may have started with him. They may have started before that, but with him, it really got a big push. Just go to the methadone clinics and hang out and pass out dope. It's the way you do it. Now, are all methadone clinics created equal? No. It depends enormously on the people who run it. It depends also on the physical layout. I believe methadone clinics need to have fenced parking lots, so that a guard can control who has personal contact with the clients coming for their methadone. If it's just wide open, as happened in Columbus, where this guy went when he first got to Columbus, first place he went was a methadone clinic. Hand out the dope. So it depends a lot on how accountable the owners are, and also on, I believe, a physical layout matters a fair amount. But these guys, wherever they go, they do that. And I know this by talking to them. I've interviewed a dozen to 15 of these guys who've worked in different parts of the country. I've also interviewed cops from Portland to South Carolina, okay? And they all do this. It's a time-honored thing. Everyone learns to do it. And the way they do it is tapping you on the shoulder. They follow the addict. They watch the guy leave. And this is why I believe a kind of confined parking lot is important, because they will, if you park three blocks away, that's ample time for them to go to the guy and say, hey, need any help? You know, and then, by the way, here's my phone number. And from methadone clinics, they develop huge markets. And again, all of this depends. There are some methadone clinics that are extremely well run, some methadone clinics that help a lot of people. There are some methadone clinics that are almost like legalized drug trafficking, and you don't, and which one it is, I don't know. You have to, each one is specific, and each one has its own story. But if our emails back and forth have been an idea, there is no doubt. There is no doubt that that's how they use this. They use methadone clinics because why? It's like the same reason you rob a bank. That's where the junkies are, right? In large numbers all day long, you know, or at least for several hours during the day. And so methadone has helped a lot of people. It's a drug that is used as a kind of a maintenance. It's like insulin for diabetics in a way. It was marketed at first as a way of weaning yourself off of heroin and stuff. That really, really is a complicated thing. It's not so easy to do. Mainly, it's maintenance. It was envisioned as maintenance for addicts who had tried and tried and tried and could not quit. And meanwhile, their lives were destroyed because heroin requires this like a big elevation and crash, you know, within a couple of hours. You're up and down all day long, up and down. You're constantly thinking, got to have the dope, got to have the dope. Your entire life is devoted to finding dope. You never talk about anything else. You don't have a relationship with anything else, anybody else that doesn't have to do with dope. Methadone doesn't have that peak and valley like that really brings on the craving. Its wave is more like this. And that's why it works. But, of course, it's an opiate, and it's enormously difficult to kick. And it is, I don't say you should get, I mean, people say it's a horrible thing. It can help, but remember, it's also a dependency. You cannot be away from methadone. You cannot say, well, you know, I think I'm going to take a vacation for a week. No, you cannot do that. You better make sure that there's a methadone clinic in the town you're going to take a vacation in, because otherwise you're going to be jonesing. And a lot of times the clinics are not well run either. So this is one of the problems, and it's very difficult because there's not a lot of accountability sometimes in these clinics and so on. They do provide a huge service, but you have to hold them accountable, and they have to have mechanisms for being held accountable, kind of like a neighborhood council kind of thing, I think, really helps. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Maybe a few questions, if you don't mind. What's the intake method for using black tar heroin? Is it injected, smoked, inhaled? And you have a feel for how many heroin users there are in the U.S.?
The first question, the answer to the first question is all of those. It's heroin. You can smoke it, you can snort it, you can inject it. You know, it's interesting how injection came about. Heroin should really have been, it was invented in 1898 by a German chemist out of Bayer, the Bayer Company. And really, it was thought to have some good quality properties, but the truth is it should have been forgotten. It should have been put on the shelf and forgotten because what it does, other drugs do better, and the risks are much higher than those other drugs, is what I'm saying. The reason it survived is because of the underworld. The underworld found it to be an enormously profitable product for just the reason I was saying. The constant rise, euphoric rise, increase in crashes, those kinds of things, that creates a customer 3 and 4 times a day. What I also, because of that, what I realize is this: once you start talking about opiates, opiates are like that. That's the way they work. They just whoom, and you got to have more. Whoom, and you got to have more. Well, because of that, this story becomes a story really of business models. You have the Jalisco business model, the pill mill business model. You have the heavy promotion of pain pills by pharmaceutical companies saying, doctors, use this. This is a solution to your most pesky chronic pain patients, you know. Because you can organize the heroin business along business school principles because the customers are constant or won't stop. And it's a drug that, or opiates in general, are drugs that just create new customers or good customers all the time. So that's part of it. But the reason we began to inject it was because this was also in New York City. This also became an immigrant's drug to sell. So the first guys to really sell in the underworld were the Italians. Lucky Luciano was first arrested. His first arrest was for heroin sales in New York City. The Italians diluted the heroin so much that in order to get any impact from it, you had to inject it. It used to be smoked like opium, you know, and no one really used the needle. But because of that, you know, you had to, because of those guys in there, that's when needle use began. Really in the 1920s and 30s due to the Italians, I think, mostly. This is what historians have written. Now, the number of addicts nationwide now is, heroin addicts is somewhere on the order of 700,000, which, you know, nationwide doesn't sound like a lot, but I've been a crime reporter a long time, and the crack epidemic was 500,000. You know, if we had 30% of the country addicted to these kinds of things, we'd have a Mad Max world, you know. I mean, it would be a country in complete and utter chaos. It's the problem is always you know, minor, seemingly minor in proportion, you know, to the general population. But that's still enough to overwhelm ERs, our rehab infrastructure. Just create misery, particularly, you know, a person gets addicted, but it's also what I've learned to truly deeply appreciate is how it brings in the entire family. All the family is part of the addiction, even though they're not using drugs. The parents are like using up all their savings or mortgaging their house, all this college savings, the hopes for the kid become minimal. You're just hoping that he gets clean, let alone college. You know, a filled life. It's hard to imagine at a certain point. And then a lot of the siblings get very resentful because all that attention, those resources of the family, are devoted to one kid. And what about me? And this kind of thing. It's a thing that kind of takes over. So 700,000 addicts is several million people involved in addiction, and several million more in and out of it, you know. So, yeah. No, go ahead.
So, I grew up in the Midwest, and what I've heard from a lot of my friends back here is that they talk about this in reality, the way they got broken. The crystal meth swamps a lot of these small rural towns like Illinois. What's the intersection of that story with this one?
Yeah, no, I don't see an intersection, honestly. And the reason is this. All of our drug scourges for the last, well, let's say since post-war, you know, World War II, have been mafia-driven, drug trafficker-driven. People selling in the underworld, right? Colombians brought in cocaine in the early 1980s, and with their machine guns, and the Miami murder rate levitated, and they've established a foothold for their market. Crack, Bloods and Crips, other street gangs got involved in it. It was, you know, they figured out, hey, if you cook cocaine with baking soda and water, it'll harden. And so that's crack, basically. Okay, that's rock cocaine. Crystal meth is the same way. Started in, it's got a weird kind of lineage, but it starts with the bikers in the 60s and cooking this very smelly concoction. But then along comes the ephedrine method you may have heard of, which is what the Nazis fed their soldiers. And so it was a formula really invented in Nazi Germany to get the soldiers to move, to be fierce, and reestablished or rediscovered in about, I want to say, the early 90s. That's when I began to write about it. The ephedrine method didn't stink as much. You can make it much more easy. Instead of 22 steps, it was now 7 steps. and you could cook in your bathroom. It was explosive, but it didn't smell like the other one, so you could do it very easily. So all of these scourges, and then what happens is the Mexican cartels figure out how to make it, and all of a sudden it goes from being a poor white person's drug to being, in L.A., I swear, it's mostly Latino gang members who use meth now. I mean, and that's largely because it switched from being a drug made by bikers for their folks and other, you know, I lived in Stockton. I was a crime reporter in Stockton. And East Stockton was where all the Okies lived, literally grandchildren of the Okies who came during the Depression. And, you know, it was pretty much a low-income white ghetto. And wow, meth was huge out there, huge. It's unbelievable how many people are using it. But then the cartels figure it out. They establish these super labs. They become very good at cooking it. I talked to a guy who was brought down to Mexico one time, a California guy, who was brought down to Mexico to teach how to cook meth to the Sinaloa cartel, members of the Sinaloa cartel. And so all of that is mafia-driven. That's our normal, you know, paradigm, right? That's a normal model. It's all mafia-driven. This is not. This is driven by U.S. doctors who are convinced by pain specialists and pharmaceutical companies that these pills are effective ways of treating pain. They may well be. In some cases, they are. But what ends up happening is the tidal waves kind of swamps all other approaches to pain. There used to be a very vibrant community of multidisciplinary pain specialists who treated chronic pain and variety of pains with all kinds of ways: acupuncture, swimming therapy, occupational therapy. They believe a lot of chronic pain is due to other factors that don't have to do with the body, with bad health choices, bad diet, or that you lost your job, or you have marital problems. A lot of this was how the pain was treated, and they were kind of competing ways in a way, in a sense. But then insurance companies began to stop funding a lot of these. And you can't really do, well, let's say there's 10 approaches. Well, we don't want to fund 6 of them. Well, 4, you know. Meanwhile, the pill is easy. It's convenient. It's quick. Boom. Here you go. It's cheap. Anyway, folks, I'm happy to sign your books. I'm happy to stick around later. But thanks very much. Thanks very much for coming. Appreciate it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.